Access number 11909, Reel 3.
Mr. Gold, Reel 3. Reel 3, yes.
As I was saying, the maps said dense mixed jungle, mainly bamboo, and that was a very fair description. It was nearly all bamboo, to be quite honest. One was so taken up with the laborious nature of hacking a way through this, and of course keeping an eye open for the enemy, that one hadn't much time to appreciate the scenic beauties. But if one had had that time, they were certainly there. I can still remember one trip along a mountain top. It was about 2,500 feet up, and it was fairly sharp and precipitous on both sides. So for the most part, one had to watch one's footwork, and I marvelled at how some of our Africans who were carrying heavy loads on their heads could nevertheless keep an amazing foothold with their army boots on this rather sort of almost alpine track. But I did have time, as I say, to look to the east, and at one point, I can still remember this, there were seven ranges of hills undulating that one could see one behind the other. And later, when I was able to study it on my map, I realised that Mandalay was just behind the seventh range, and that was certainly one of the great views in that area. You didn't usually have much time for admiring the scenery, but I can remember that one.
What was bamboo like to cope with?
The African used his machete, and that could slice through bamboo quite easily. And either from the point of view of cutting a track or of cutting bamboo poles to make temporary shelters and things, the machete cut through it quite easily. But it was, of course, it was a nasty growth, because by the same token, when you sliced off a bamboo rod, you left a rather sharp stump there, and you had to be very careful when you were working around that not to put your foot on it. Particularly in their case, some of them were in bare feet, and they'd get rather nasty jabs. But bamboo, it was very, very thickly growing and very dense, but it could be cleared with much more ease than a lot of the other types of tree, I would think.
Did you get jungle saws through the cuts?
I personally was not given to getting that, but one of my fellow officers had a very nasty time. He was rather prone to that, and he got a cactus infection, and that laid him up for quite a while. It was easy to get these infections. Personally, I was lucky.
What kind of troubles did you have with the animal life in the bamboo forest?
Do you know, I never saw a single type. As I've said, the leeches, which upset a lot of people, particularly when you were sort of ploughing your way through marshy and wet ground, never bothered me. And literal animal life, and we never saw any at all. It must have been either by the Japs or by us, must have been scared away completely. All we saw, other than our enemy occasionally, was the odd local Burmese native who were called Mugs, M-H-U-G. You could never tell whether they were friendly or hostile, because they were impervious to both threats and cajolery. They seemed to be completely disinterested in what was going on at all. But other than a few of them, and there weren't many, mostly old men, apart from them, we saw no form of human life other than our enemies, I say, occasionally.
You told me earlier off tape that you weren't even troubled by mosquitoes, personally.
I personally wasn't, no. My metabolism or whatever must have been all right for that. But, of course, most people were, and the mepicrine was essential to most of them. Fortunately, not to me.
And you didn't even take the mepicrine?
I didn't, in the end, take it, although I think I'm safe after all these years, but disciplinary action might have been taken against me if it had been known at the time, because you were urged to take it.
Why did you stop taking it?
Because I found it merely made me all yellow, and it didn't seem at all necessary, because, I say, the mosquitoes didn't bother me. Possibly it was rather stupid of me, but at the time it seemed to me just superfluous.
Did you have any sickness at all in Burma?
None at all, other than a little bit of muscular trouble in the knee, but otherwise nothing at all.
And your African soldiers, were they healthy?
Mostly healthy, by and large, yes, very healthy.
Do you think that the African troops were satisfied with the conditions under which they were fighting, or were they discontented?
Well, I suppose it's fair to say there was the occasional grumbler, but not in any official sense, and not in any great degree. I think, on the whole, like most soldiers, they had their personal moans now and then, but no, they were, on the whole, they seemed to accept it with equanimity.
What were the things which bothered them most, do you think?
I think it's only fair to say the same things that bothered most troops abroad. When can we get home? Food could be a bit better. The usual stuff, but nothing really serious and nothing worrying.
Did they feed in the same way as you?
They had the same food, yes, largely. Which was mostly, as far as I recall, bully beef and that sort of stuff, which they were very good at making up into all sorts of hashes and curries and so forth for themselves and in the officers' mess for us when we had a mess. But, of course, in the bush, we just had to eat improvised as we could.
You said what their attitude towards the Japanese enemy was. What was your own attitude?
In what sense do you mean, Quaid?
Did you hate them yourself?
I think it's fair to say, yes. Yes, I worked up a fairly healthy animosity to them, yes.
Was that because of treatment of prisoners?
Yes. Well, what we had already learned about what happened at Singapore and various other places made us fairly short-tempered, so to speak, as far as they were concerned.
Was there any sense of what on earth are we doing fighting here in this remote part?
There could have been that, certainly not in those with whom I was associated or discussed things with. No, we merely felt it was an area where there was a job to do, and that was that. I think it's fair to say, and you'll probably have heard this from many sources before, that as the... and the war went on, we got more and more the feeling, which I think the press even took up, that the 14th Army was the forgotten army. Possibly or largely unjustified, but merely a sort of a personal feeling, until when the VE Day came in May, which, of course, everybody, even in our area, greeted with great glee. But then when we read in the publications that came out to us that what is going to happen now the war is over, there was a wave of bitterness out in our corner, our reaction being, war's over. They should come out here and see if it's over, because it wasn't for another 3 months.
Did you take any Japanese prisoners in your battalion?
No. Well, it's possible that one or two were taken. I personally never saw a live Jap. I heard them, as I say, at many yards distance, and I saw one or two dead ones, but I never... was confronted with a live Jap anywhere. I suppose we were fighting at long range, so to speak, particularly as most of my work was done with a mortar section where I was about 800 yards or so away from them. It would be difficult to get close quarters. But no, I never had any personal experience of first-hand contact with them.
Would you have been willing to take prisoners?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'd pass them on pretty quickly, I should think. But yes, I wouldn't have any compunction about it. I think if they surrendered, I would have. I would not have thought of sort of just gunning them down, though they had surrendered. No, I would have tried to play according to the book and pass them on, being very careful, because I wouldn't trust them all that much.
What did you think of them as soldiers, the Japanese?
Extremely good soldiers, if unimaginative, in the sense that they merely carried out orders, but they carried them out, as far as I could see, to the letter, even to the extent of dying where they stood.
Were you glad to get out of Burma?
Yes, yes, I think so. After all, we had been in and out for about better part of 2.5 years. Oh, I think so, yes. At the same time, looking back, there was an awful lot about it that I quite enjoyed.
What was that?
Well, seeing quite a lot of parts of the world I wouldn't have otherwise seen. I don't say I enjoyed hiking through the jungle. You'd have to have a very masochistic sense of emotion to enjoy that. But as I say, I saw most of India as a result of this these campaigns. I wouldn't particularly want to go back again. I think I've seen all I need to of it, but I was grateful for that. And I learnt to like the troops we had with us very much. I was very attached to them.
Did the what was your unit much in India after the end of the Arakan campaigns, before they went back to West Africa?
We came out by about the... let me put it this way. We were at our base camp, training, in fact, with the presumed intention of going down into Malaya if the end of the war hadn't come. So in August, we were at our base camp. There was then a period of about 6 months of rather frustrating sort of sitting still, doing nothing, wondering when, well, both the Africans and ourselves wondering when we're going to get back. It wasn't, I must admit, assisted by the current feeling in India at the time, which whenever we went into any of the big towns like Madras or so forth, we saw notices up, British, get out. To which our reaction was, if only we could. But, as I say, from about August and for nearly 6 months or over 6 months, we sat about waiting, or our troops sat about waiting to news going back. And then in about the end of March, things started to move. And by April, they were all, or nearly all, en route in troop ships through the Mediterranean and back to West Africa.
Whereabouts in Madras did you see the British get out notices?
On the walls, painted on the walls in the streets of in the centre of the town, mostly. You know, the chalk marks and that sort of thing out on the walls.
Did you feel much hostility from the Indians at that time?
Not from the Indian people with whom we had any contact, which were only those at the sort of clubs, restaurants and hotels and so forth we stayed in, because we were about 40 or 50 miles back in the ground behind Madras. You see. We only came in for sort of evenings or weekends and so forth. And no, they were perfectly. I mean, it was good business for them. They were quite quite pleasant. But the obviously there was this underlying feeling, as turned out quite obviously when the independence came the following year.
Whereabouts were you outside Madras?
At a place called Kalahasti, which was almost a desert camp. The nearest town was one called Reniganta. It was about equidistant along the highway from Madras to Bangalore.
Some people who write history books speculate on the possible effects on African soldiers who served in the Second World War abroad in South and Southeast Asia of the experience of being abroad and the broadening of horizons on their attitudes, and they try to link this up with the political developments regarding the move towards independence in Africa after the war. Do you think, from your own experience of serving with African troops in Asia, that this could have had an effect, that they may have come into contact with ideas about independence and a broadening of horizons?
There's undoubtedly, there must be some elements of, as you put it, the spirit of independence which got through to them. I don't think this took the obvious aspect of any of them, when they were in India, talking to political agitators and so forth. I'm nearly certain that that would not have occurred. But I think there is undoubtedly a case to be made for the fact that when they came back, some of them, and I think now of the slightly educated ones that I'm talking about, who worked in the company office and so forth, possibly joining the independence movement because they felt that they had now seen the world and that they'd seen areas where they were not regarded as native subjects, so to speak. I think that the general broadening of their minds through going abroad must have soaked in to some extent and possibly assisted the movement. Unfortunately, of course, it seems, this is merely a personal view, but it seems that they were all of them granted independence rather precipitately and before they had worked out or accustomed themselves to ruling their own countries. And you have to look all over Africa and you find things economically in a mess, mostly. However, that's just a personal view. But I do think that probably the fact that they were drafted overseas to this sphere, in the eastern sphere in Burma, may have indirectly contributed, but I don't think that any of them were sort of got at by political agitators.
Why do you think that that would have been extremely unlikely?
Because in the nature of things, I don't think they could have been got at, so to speak. We were out in a camp, miles from anywhere. None of them went into Madras, which was the only big town near us, when we were at base, I'm talking about, of course, and other times they wouldn't have the time or the opportunity. But I can't imagine any Indians. We didn't have any Indian staff with us at the camp. Can't any agitators infiltrating into there. If they did, they must have been extremely skillful and almost non-invisible.
Was there no opportunity for the Africans to go to Madras?
No. There wasn't. It wouldn't have been practical.
Mm.
No, I don't think so, no, at all.
But do you think the sight of these anti-British slogans in Madras might have had an effect on them?
Funnily enough, I don't think so. I may be overlooking something quite seriously, but I don't think that they had any... the chaps that were fighting with us had any anti-British sentiment. I could be quite wrong, but I never saw... I won't say I never saw any example. I had a company clerk in headquarter company who, I am sure, I haven't heard high in the hair of him for 45 years, but I am nearly certain that he would be one amongst those who agitated for independence when he got back, because he was always ready to pick on grievances. You get these people in every, whatever their colour, in every unit, I'm sure. But this fellow, I'm quite certain, would have been in the forefront of that. And to that extent, possibly, his sojourn in the battalion, in the campaign, may have contributed.
Where did he come from?
He came from Accra. You know, the capital of Gold Coast, as it then was.
What type of things would he be aggrieved about?
Oh, I think nothing material, but simply the fact that he was... that why should we be treated as second rate? Which, there's no doubt they were, I mean, at that time. And he would think, you know, we're as good as the next man. I think that can be the only explanation I can give, not a very full one. But
what type of things would he say explicitly to you?
Oh, he wouldn't say anything explicitly to me. He was far too careful for that. But I could see him sort of many a time... almost sniggering to himself about something, and he would never say anything about it, but I knew that he had a feeling that I remember that. Just a feeling I had. But he was, let me hasten to say, greatly the exception to the rule. The main rule was they were all quite, I wouldn't say devoted, but quite enthusiastic in their support for us, particularly some of the senior NCOs who were splendid fellows.
Do you remember any of their names?
My company sergeant major, African company sergeant major in headquarter company, whose name was Brimer Cardo, yes, I remember him very well. He was a young man at the time, but he was a patriarchal figure with a beard, and very efficient, had his men behind him, and a devout Muslim. And whenever we were out in the campaign, before he unrolled his bedroll and got down for the evening, he used to ask me to show him my compass so that he could put his prayer mat out and face the east.
Were most of your troops Muslim?
The majority were, what do you call them? Pagan, I think they call them. But there was a large element of Muslims, particularly, of course, in the Nigerian regiment. The Gold Coast regiment had their number. Quite a considerable minority were Christians, having been brought up in missions and so forth.
Were they much different from the others?
Not really. Not basically, no. No. You couldn't typify either, as far as their military demeanour or conduct was concerned, you couldn't distinguish between a Christian largely nominal, I must admit, a Muslim or a pagan. There were good ones, there were bad ones, as soldiers.